always be clear where you get your conservative talk.
The St. Louis Business Journal is now reporting that liberal billionaire George Soros is the largest shareholder of Odyssey,
the parent company of KMOX and 97.1 Talk.
Soros' maneuver raises critical questions about the future of media ownership and influence.
Money and attention is power. And when he has the money and he controls what's on the radio stations, he's going to be able to control the minds, essentially hundreds of millions of Americans.
St. Louis's trusted source and number one.
For conservative talk.
This is News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome into Thursday's edition. It'll be a Thunderdome Thursday indeed, as we are on Trump Trial Watch. A verdict has been reached. Welcome to 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL, your number one station in the region for live and local conservative talk. And we always bring you the breaking news of the day. Didn't want to bury the lead there. However, I also have another very important announcement. It is the birthday of one Chris Arms.
Thank you. I almost forgot that. I was like, I wonder what the announcement is. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yes, 58 years old today. And I want to, first of all, publicly thank everyone that has called and texted and left messages on my Facebook and everything. It is absolutely overwhelming to for people to take time out of their day to wish you a happy birthday. So thank you so much, Tim. I'm a blessed man. I have a blessed political and radio career. I've got the greatest wife a man could ever want, the greatest friends, and live in the greatest country in the world, and best of all, have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. So I know where I'm going after this trip is over. So life is good.
And you're wearing your News Talk STL swag
and hat.
And I matched you today as well. I got my lid out in the car. Chris, we are here. We are live. The verdict has been reached in the New York versus Trump trial. The judge is addressing the jury right now. We're going to go to the Big Fox here in just a second. Joey V, how you doing today? You ready for a wild ride, roller coaster day here?
I was just enjoying my avocado toast in the other room, and someone said, get in that studio. Trump verdict is in. So I'm just wiping the green smudges off my shirt, and we're going to do some real radio here.
You know, Joey is the ultimate poker face player there, so you'll never know if he's excited, not excited.
Joey, I think we should go to the feed here. It looks like they're starting to get some word as to what the verdict is. Let's bring this up and see what they are saying.
A split of folks here who have been protesting on both sides of this case. Some cheer, some boos, as we are now getting the information from the jury. We're up to 18 counts, 19 guilty. Remember, we have 34 here, 20 guilty. And again, these counts were very similar, what they were looking at. It was different occurrences, essentially, of the same crime, a misdemeanor that was elevated by being linked to a felony, to an underlying crime. We are now 24 counts in, all guilty from inside. This is what we are hearing from our producers, up to 26 guilty. Now, remember, each of these counts could maximum have 4 years in jail. President Trump would be considered a first-time offender. These are non-violent crimes. So it seems that it is unlikely the judge would sentence him to prison. But we are now up to 31 counts guilty out of 34. 32 guilty, also coming in from inside the courtroom. Our producers now saying 33 and 34. They're saying guilty on all 34 charges. That is where we are at. The jurors, it looks like we're going to leave for the day. Suddenly we get this verdict. It is 34 guilty counts on all of this. I want to bring in Andy McCarthy, who's here with me, Judge Jeanine as well, and Trey Gowdy. Andy, where we go from here, obviously there will automatically be an appeal from this Trump team as quickly as possible. There's the legal issue of sentencing to come. That's going to take maybe months to get to a pretrial report on this, and then to a sentencing by the judge. And he reminded the jurors he's the one who decides. But we have the reality now of a former president for the first time being convicted on 34 criminal counts, guilty on all of these counts. Whatever conflict or confusion or questions the jury had, they got that information back to them this morning. And by the end of day two of deliberations, we're at 34 guilty counts for the former president of the United States of America.
It's a historic trial of a former president of the United States by his partisan adversaries. Whatever you think of the results, it's inconceivable in New York that anyone else other than Donald Trump would ever been indicted in this way. By Alvin Bragg, the elected progressive Democratic district attorney who campaigned on the fact that he would go after Donald Trump, that he had a history of going after Donald Trump. This is a very political exercise, and you have to say that it accomplished what it set out to accomplish. What they wanted was to have a situation where they could call Donald Trump a convicted felon in the run-up to the election. Mm-hmm. We have an elected Democrat who got that accomplished. He got a very friendly judge who ruled his way on every important thing and turned the jury instructions into a roadmap to conviction. So now I assume, with the mission having been accomplished, we'll have more procedural regularity, Shannon. As you just said, there'll be a pre-sentence investigation. Mm-hmm. There should be a sentencing scheduled, and we'll go from there. But this case will be appealed, and I hope that there'll be more fairness and equity in the appeal than there was in the trial.
And Trey, when these counts, this indictment first came in, there were a lot of people across the political and legal spectrum who said, this feels like the weakest case against President Trump. Something changed along the way. How much of this had to do with the guidance from Judge Merchan, whether it was the jury instructions, whether it was the decisions on objections, whether it was the decision not to let in certain witnesses that the defense wanted to call?
All of the above. The verdict is a necessary and probable consequence of everything that happens up to that point. So that includes jury selection. It includes evidentiary rulings. I was in the courtroom or the overflow room 4 different days. Shannon, it wasn't just the result of Judge Merchan's rulings. The tone of his voice was different depending on which side was doing the objecting. So, you know, look, I said a week ago, juries usually get it right based on the information they're given. When you don't get to hear from an FEC expert, when you hear both proximity and propensity evidence against the defendant, and by that I mean he was close to 2 people who were guilty, therefore he must be guilty, and you hear salacious details with Stormy Daniels. I mean, I didn't ever think it was going to be an acquittal, having been in the courtroom. I thought it might be a hung jury, 10-2, 11-1. But verdict is only the result of what you're given up until that point. So this is not a surprising
result. The former congressman, the former federal prosecutor, Trey Gowdy, who is a Republican but is not a Trump sycophant at all, just hit the nail on the head. Chris, this verdict is a probable and almost necessary result. And I say that as a huge Trump fan, from what was orchestrated before them. This case from beginning to end was orchestrated to reach this verdict. I'm not surprised at it by at all.
Yeah, it was before we came on the air. I'll give you credit, Mr. Speaker. You said that you had a bad feeling that a guilty verdict was going to come back. All 34 counts, as we heard in that report. I have to tell you, I'm sad for my country today. This is banana republic type of stuff, to twist the law in such a way to try to get a conviction before the election. This is election interference at the height, and this is just it's a sad situation. Tim, as that commentator said, the Democrats now have what they want. Now they can campaign and say that Donald Trump is a convicted felon. They are trying to use lawfare to do what they couldn't do in the electoral process, and it's a sad day today.
Chris, you've encapsulated my emotions rather well. My emotions are not, I'm not angry. I'm not angry at all at this. I'm sad. I'm disappointed. I'm disenchanted with our system, Chris, which I thought, despite all of its warts, its necessity from time to time of getting things absolutely wrong. We've gotten things very wrong in U.S. history, but we still always eventually get to the right conclusion, right? Yeah. Sometimes it takes us generations. But we're the only country on earth that learns from its wrongs and tries to be better. We try to aspire to be a nation of freedom, liberty, and justice. Sean Davis, there's a lot of reaction coming in right now. Sean Davis from The Federalist says this. We all know the verdict already. He put this up right before the verdict came out. We all know the verdict already because this thing was rigged from the beginning. A dirty prosecutor ran an illegal case using a corrupt judge and a jury pool of left-wing Biden voters to convict and sideline the ruling regime's top political opponent. You don't hate these people nearly as much as they deserve. I think Sean Davis and many others hitting the nail on the head. this was a weaponization of our justice system to go after the top political opponent of the current ruling party's adversary this fall.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see in the future a repeat of what we've seen many, many times when it comes to Trump, where his detractors think that they've cornered him and think that they've have finally got him. They'll see that they don't. I'm not a lawyer, but I have been following this semi-closely and listening to all the legal experts and, you know, especially Andy
McCarthy.
I mean, he's talking about the judge's instructions, how the judge just bent over backwards where it seemed for the prosecution. I heard one person saying it might have been McCarthy, that this judge was so in the tank for the prosecution that when he opened the case and said to the defense, are you ready? Then he turned to the prosecution and said, are we ready? And I think that pretty much describes it when you see these judges' instructions and how he conducted himself in this case.
Chris, as we know, the left has taught us that pronoun usage is very important in today's world.
Yeah.
So if we're saying we as referring to the prosecutor, Chris, you know what? You know, as part of one of the future speaker stump speeches in the near future, I should probably download the jury instructions once they become publicly available.
And talk about that,
and
Tim,
read those on the air.
Is this normal to have where it takes an hour and a half to read jury instructions? Are they usually that complicated? I'm glad you brought that up.
No, they're never short.
Yeah.
And they always tend to have legalese in them, but they don't tend to be so complicated. And Chris, you're right. Andy McCarthy, we heard him before we came on the air. He said this case appeared to be an absolute disastrous mess until the jury instructions. Mm. And then he said the jury instructions seemed to make the case for the prosecutors that they couldn't make for themselves.
Yeah.
And led the jury to almost the verdict that they needed to reach. It was like it was directing them to that spot.
And one way that helped with that, I learned yesterday that in New York, the jury doesn't get the instructions written down. You have to take basically good notes as a juror. And if you want to hear testimony again or whatever, you've got to go back and ask them, hey, I want to hear such and such at this point. But they can't give them a written record of the jury instructions.
Right.
So you're supposed to just listen to an hour and a half worth of jury instructions, take that in as a non-lawyer and give a verdict.
And this idea that we talked about yesterday, Chris, where the instructions as to the misdemeanors, the two misdemeanors, which were somehow supposed to be combined with each other and then elevated to felony status because of this vague, ambiguous, amorphous reference to federal elections law. Did you know, folks, they never identified the actual violation of federal election law that Trump was supposed to have been allegedly committed.
Yeah.
They said, you can choose amongst any of these four possible alternatives, and all of you don't have to agree on one of the four. Some of you could agree it was this one.
Yeah.
Some of you could agree. I don't know, Chris, how that is possibly not reversible error. In a criminal trial, my understanding as someone who went to law school, has passed two state bars, former prosecutor, practiced for 20 years, did jury trials, how you're suddenly changing the standard of the burden of proof for the elements of a criminal case to not having unanimity of beyond the reasonable doubt on these particular elements. I just found out, Chris, Katie just texted us, and we have got a big get. We're going to be joined by an attorney, a practicing lawyer who does nothing but practice law every day. Attorney General Andrew Bailey is going to join us, I think, at 4:45, and he's going to talk to us about his reaction. So, Chris, these are great questions to ask him, because Andrew Bailey is someone who's involved in preparing jury instructions every single week of his life, likely, as the head law enforcement officer of this state. So we'll ask him that question.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the many grounds. Sentencing, we just learned sentencing has been set for July the 11th. If people are wondering how was he found guilty on 34 counts, look, if he was found guilty, Chris, on
he's
one
speaking.
Count.
Let's hear if he's speaking.
Yeah, let's go ahead and see what they're talking about the sentencing here.
Trial by a conflicted
Trump's
judge
talking.
Who is corrupt. There's a rigged trial, a disgrace. They wouldn't give us a venue change. We were at 5% or 6% in this district, in this area. This was a rigged, disgraceful trial. The real verdict is going to be November 5th by the people. And they know what happened here, and everybody knows what happened here. You have a Soros-backed DA, and the whole thing, we didn't do a thing wrong. I'm a very innocent man, and it's okay. I'm fighting for our country. I'm fighting for our Constitution. Our whole country is being rigged right now. This was done by the Biden administration in order to wound or hurt an opponent, a political opponent. And I think it's just a disgrace. And we'll keep fighting. We'll fight till the end and we'll win. Because our country's gone to hell. We don't have the same country anymore. We have a divided mess. We're a nation in decline, serious decline. Millions and millions of people pouring into our country right now from prisons and from mental institutions, terrorists. And they're taking over our country. We have a country that's in big trouble. But this was a rigged decision right from day one with a conflicted judge who should have never been allowed to try this case, never. And we will fight for our Constitution. This is long from over. Thank you very much.
Tim, I was going to make the point before we saw the president making his statement. Let's take the legal aspect out of the judge and just look at it from the political standpoint that these people now, this is just naked. They're not even trying to hide what they're trying to do. I mean, this was a kangaroo court prosecution, a kangaroo trial. The judge's instructions were inappropriate. A lot of legal experts say that, but they are so invested on making sure that Donald Trump is not elected president again and protecting Joe Biden that they are willing to just, what's the word that they used in Breaking Bad for Gus when he just was hiding in plain sight? That's what they're doing. That's what Judge Merchan is doing. This is hiding in plain sight of trying to hijack an election and railroad someone into jail.
Look, I can tell you, as a former practicing lawyer who has done jury trials, whether you like it or not, many times your case is decided at the point of jury selection. It's something that lawyers discuss all the time. Now, the lawyers don't know, but they generally have a feeling. And yeah, is some of it based on stereotypes? Is some of it based on actual data? Is some of it based on the biographical information, the things that lawyers learn during the long jury selection process? Let's remember, they took many days to select this jury. These lawyers were confronted with people that none of them knew, but then they learned much about them.
Right.
And I can tell you that the cake may have already been baked before the ingredients were even put in the mixing bowl, depending on the jury. Trump's right. He was not being adjudicated by a jury of his peers. Let's be honest about that. This is a jurisdiction that voted for Biden by nearly 90%. Yeah. So did they find the 10% of people that voted for Trump? I doubt it. And, you know, that wouldn't have been necessarily fair either. Did they find a mixture? I doubt that either. I will bet you this jury leaned heavily against Trump from the very beginning. I think we all probably held out hope that, okay, now the process will take over. Our system will take over. It will be fair and balanced. From everything we've heard, and Chris and I did not sit in this courtroom, but we heard a lot of the reaction. We heard a lot of the testimony from people who did go to this courtroom. And what did we hear time and time again? The judge was obviously biased. The judge was putting his finger on the scale. The judge treated the prosecution and the defense very differently. The judge ruled on his objections in different ways. He said things in different ways. The tone of his voice, his expressions. You look at his history. His family is deeply embedded with the Democratic Party and with left-leaning interests, donors, etc., and so forth. I mean, let's be honest. This was not a fair trial, and it wasn't in a fair jurisdiction. And so the verdict that was reached, It was one that we had hoped wouldn't happen, but if we go back to the beginning, it's one that we likely all expected.
All right, let's get the Bucci.
Okay.
All right.
Sorry. I was not paying attention at the time. That's Chris Harps. I'm Tim Jones, producer Joey V on a big, busy day here. Does this have national security implications? Does prosecuting the political opponent of the ruling regime in the country have ramifications beyond our shores? We'll ask Steve Bucci that next and so much more when we come back on the Tim Jones and Chris Harps Show at 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on NewsTalkSTL.com.
Does the president still believe that the temporary pier is a viable platform to get aid into Gaza?
Absolutely. As a supplement, okay, it was never intended to supplant what you can do on the ground through trucks and getting those crossings open. We said that from the get-go. We also said it's going to be tough. It's been tough. Weather plays a role. I mean, Mother Nature has a say here, and the Eastern Med, even in the summertime, can be a pretty rough place, and that's what's happening right now. But can it be a force multiplier? Can it add to? Absolutely. And I think they've so far gotten more than 1,000 metric tons in just off the temporary pier alone, which, you know what, considering the weather, considering the complexity of doing it that way, the multi-node stop you have to do to move from ship to pier to truck to ground, that's still an impressive record so far.
4:30 on the Tim Jones and Chris Harp Show, and the big news today, if you have not heard, President Donald Trump was convicted on all 34 charges in his so-called quote-unquote hush money trial. You want to keep listening to us at 4:45. We will have Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey on to discuss that case. But now we're going to switch here to world affairs, the military news. On the line is our favorite military analyst,
Steve Bucci, visiting fellow for Special Ops at the Heritage Foundation.
Oh, yes. What were you about to ask me?
Do you expect me to talk?
Steve, welcome to the show. You heard that clip there about the $300 million pier that is breaking up in the sea there. But before we get to that, I want to talk about the big news of the day here about President Trump being found guilty. Tim and I both have said that this makes our country look like a banana republic. This is not the America that we grew up in. Our adversaries around the world, what are they thinking when they see this type of political prosecution of a former president?
Well, they're probably scratching their heads. They recognize this is not the norm that we have lived in America before. And to be frank, a lot of times, at least the leaders of other countries pay attention to the details of these kind of controversies even more than we do, because to them, it's really relevant that, you know, if America goes off the rails, that's a bad thing for everybody. So I think there's a lot of confusion in the world, particularly when you hear, you know, different legal experts talking about how strange the conduct of the trial was. You know, the idea that for these things to become actual crimes, they had to be connected to some crime predicate. And the judge gives him advice. Well, you don't have to agree on what the predicate is. It could be different things to different people. But it's like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like our legal system. Now, I'll be honest with you, I'm not a lawyer. So I think when your AG comes in, I think it's going to be probably a lot more accurate a discussion than for me. But as a citizen looking at it, it's a head scratcher, and I think it's got to be more so for our friends and our adversaries overseas as they wonder, you know, what the heck is going on in America today?
Yeah, Steve, to follow up on that point, I think you're looking at it, Steve, the way most people are. I am a recovering attorney, and I actually used to be a prosecutor, and so, you know, I probably know a little bit more than the average duck, but I'm just trying to think about what people like you, Steve, and others who don't know all the intricacies of a prosecution must be thinking, because that's what most people are going to think. And Steve, you can comment on what people around the world are probably thinking. Steve, what about all of the tin pot dictators and the third world banana republic despots? They're probably looking at the U.S., shrugging their shoulders and going, well, so much for the world's greatest superpower and land of freedom and liberty. They're no better than us anymore. They're going to persecute their political adversaries just like we do. That's a pretty dangerous place for the U.S. to be in. But if you take a 35,000-foot look, that's probably what a lot of them are thinking today, right?
Yeah. You know, people like Vladimir Putin are going to look at it and say, well, I tell you what, America is not going to be able to throw shade on our elections anymore because they are doing exactly the same stuff that we do. So the moral high ground that we have always had with regards to the conduct of elections and the actions before and after elections is gone. It's been completely demolished by what the Dems have done. And, you know, when you have Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who says out loud what they're thinking, well, all of these trials, it's just like having an ankle bracelet on Trump so he can't go out and campaign. So, I mean, she stated what most of us believed, was that these things are not about legal process. It's not about crimes. It's about lawfare against former President Trump and an effort to hamstring him so he cannot campaign effectively for the coming presidential election. And that's just, you know, to put it in a more street sense, it's a crappy way to do business. It means you don't feel that your candidate can beat him head to head, so you've got to, you know, hobble him so he can't really run. And it's just, you know, it's going to cost us in the long run of credibility and, as I say, the moral high ground that we've always had with regard to our election process.
Speaking with Steve Bucci, visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Steve, the $350 million pier that we have built in Gaza to try to get humanitarian aid into the refugees there, that pier has been destroyed. We're learning that that pier cannot work in waters over 3 feet high, I think. The waves there in that area are known to be 4 feet and above. This is a monumental failure. Who is to blame for this?
Well, I mean, ultimately, President Biden's to blame, and his military advisors who said, yeah, boss, we can do this. But it's, you know, look, I feel badly for my engineer colleagues in the military who, you know, trying to do this kind of operation is a pretty Herculean task. But it is dependent on the sea state, on the type of beaches. That sort of very specialized equipment doesn't work everywhere. And I think, you know, I'm positive that they advised President Biden and the Secretary of Defense that these were possibilities, that this could break down. But they were so determined to virtue signal and to show that they were doing stuff to get food into the Palestinians, when frankly the Israelis were scratching their heads and saying, you know, this stuff is going through these points into Gaza. Where it's going once it gets in there, that's not on us, that's on Hamas, because Hamas was stealing this stuff. And then we find out after the military engineers build this giant thing for this extraordinary amount of money, and we offload the first couple of shipments, and our folks on the ground, Americans on the ground watching it, saying, look, we have no idea where any of it went. This many tons went in, but everybody is saying, well, we didn't get any food, and it's because we know Hamas stole it all, just like they steal it from all the other points where humanitarian aid comes in. And now that the whole thing is broken up, it's one, we've wasted a very valuable piece of equipment that, put in a different situation, would have done its job well. And two, we really didn't help anybody. You know, listening to Admiral Kirby and the White House spokesperson talking about, well, it's really this is a success. You know, if you don't want to call it a success, you can do that. But we fed people. Well, that, just last week, they were saying, we don't have any idea where any of the aid went. So we wasted a bunch of money. We put people's lives at risk. And now the result is we've destroyed a piece of valuable equipment and we didn't really help anybody very much. So it's kind of a big mess. And the administration owns it. Nobody made them do this. They said, oh, we've got a suggestion. We'll fix this problem. Not so much. Hmm.
Steve, in moving on to other notorious subjects, the UN, which I'm going to ask, part of my question is, do they serve any purpose anymore? The UN is being rather universally slammed for holding a meeting to honor the recently deceased, commonly referred to Butcher of Tehran, the Iranian president who went down in the helicopter crash last week. Many calling it absolutely outright offensive. The UN Security Council held a minute of silence to mourn his death. I mean, Steve, the concept of the UN was good, but in the beginning, but like everything created by government, it seems to have gone completely off the rails. For those who say this is no big deal or don't worry about it, how offensive was this truly for the UN to do this? And back to my earlier question, does the UN serve much of a notable purpose anymore in the world for freedom, liberty, democracy, and constitutional republics?
Well, going to your first question, it is offensive to honor this man. You know, it's anybody dies in an accident, that's a shame, okay. But in this case, Raisi was a bad person. Mm-hmm. He holds the record for having hung more demonstrators, tortured more demonstrators, incarcerated more demonstrators than any president in Iran's history, hence his nickname, the Butcher of Tehran that you mentioned. And to sit there and act like, oh no, he's a wonderful guy, what a shame that he died, when there are the expatriate communities, Iranian communities around the world, were holding festivals of celebration over it, and even people inside Iran, where it's really dangerous to do this sort of thing, they were celebrating as well. Not everyone, but you know, goodly numbers of people, particularly those who lost family members due to the decisions and the actions of this man. And to sit there around the world and in a place like the UN and give him, you know, give condolences, to offer a moment of silence, he is not a hero. The closest thing we've come to, and you guys are close to this one geographically, is the recent announcement that, you know, oh, we need to honor the icon Michael Brown. You know, like he was a hero. He tried to attack a policeman right after he had robbed a convenience store. That man, you know, that officer did not execute Brown. Brown attacked him, and that officer protected himself, as was found out by the Obama Department of Justice. But today they're celebrating him as a, quote, hero. And the same thing with Raisi. People's memory can be very selective, and in this case it's wrong. Now getting to your second question, sorry, I got a little
off. That's okay.
You know, does the UN serve any purpose now? At the very least, you have to say a lot less of a purpose than it may have in the past. I think they are off the rails on so many things. Mm-hmm. Their people have hijacked organizations that were meant for good, and now they're using them terribly. Israel just made the decision to expel the UN, UNRWA, from Jerusalem, because they've had employees who were acting as agents of Hamas. And you can't tell me that the leadership of that organization didn't know that. But that doesn't seem to be a problem. The only problem that's there is what the Jews do. And I just can't countenance that. And I don't think we should be paying the billions of dollars we pay to the mm-hmm. UN every year mm-hmm. for it to be a platform to attack the United States and attack our allies when they say nothing about Russia in Ukraine. They say nothing about, you know, the Uyghurs in China. It's ridiculous, the selectivity of their outrage. And the UN is a prime example of it.
Steve, Tim, and I probably have five more questions each for you, but as you mentioned, we do have Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey coming up, so we want to give him plenty of time as well. But, you know, we always love speaking with you, sir, and we look forward to speaking with you again next Thursday. Steve Bucci, visiting fellow of the Heritage Foundation. You can reach him at S. Bucci, B-U-C-C-I, on Twitter or X. Steve, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and I don't mind ceding the time to the Attorney General. He's a great guest to have on.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it so much. We agree with that. Yes, 444, and Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey will be back with us talking about this Trump verdict, found guilty on all 34 counts. We'll get his thoughts next on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL, number one for live and local conservative talk.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
This was a rigged, disgraceful trial. The real verdict is going to be November 5th by the people. And they know what happened here, and everybody knows what happened here.
447 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. And if you've not heard, President Donald Trump was found guilty today on all 34 charges in his so-called hush money trial. On the line with us is Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey. Attorney General, we thank you so much for joining us on this short notice. I guess we have to ask you your initial thoughts on the verdict.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for having me on. This is a dark day in the history of our Democratic Republic. You know, this is lawfare on a level never seen before in this country. You know, you've got a Manhattan district attorney who on his website claims one standard of justice for all, and yet while crime runs rampant through the streets of New York City, dedicates countless resources to a sham prosecution, an illicit witch hunt of President Trump. And it was never intended to obtain a legally valid conviction. And I think that your listeners will understand, and certainly legal scholars know, that the conviction that was obtained today is not legally valid, will be remedied at the Court of Appeals and in the Court of Public Opinion. The intent here was always to take President Trump off of the campaign trail. And Alvin Bragg was successful at that. And that's the biggest shame of all, that the rules of the game, the rules of law, has been perverted to achieve a political objective by Alvin Bragg and by President Biden as well. I think President Trump is right when he accuses President Biden of engaging in this kind of lawfare. I mean, certainly the Department of Justice under President Biden has conducted lawfare against President Trump. They've deployed Matthew Colangelo, the formerly third-ranking official in Biden's Department of Justice, longtime DNC activist, to be the lead prosecutor in Alvin Bragg's office. You got to be kidding me. That alone is enough evidence to get both of those prosecutors disqualified from this case. The case itself was never supported by the facts or the law. You've got the illicit motivations of the prosecutors themselves. They should have been disqualified. And then the judge rigged it. I mean, by not giving the jury instructions, by allowing them to avoid jury unanimity in determining what the actual predicate offense could be, the whole thing was rigged. It's a sham witch hunt. And the problem will be corrected. It's going to take time. But here's the call to action. The left needs to understand that if there are no rules to the game, and if the rules of the game are lawfare, that can boomerang against them as well.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Attorney General, Tim Jones here. Thanks so much for joining us today. Yes. I'm sure you're going to be in high demand, so we appreciate you jumping right on our show as soon as we were able to reach you. I would love to unpack some of the things you mentioned, because this is what's going to come next. People need to first understand that this is just the beginning of the road. Many of us expected this. We hoped that the system would somehow prevail over this extremely anti-Trump jury, which is, I'm sure, what they were. Trey Gowdy, the former congressman, former federal prosecutor, not a Trump sycophant at all, recently said, I think he said it this morning, we still don't know what the secondary crime was. Mr. Attorney General, yeah, back to those jury instructions. Would you explain to our audience what is reversible error, and do you think those jury instructions were manufactured to almost force the jury to reach the result that they did?
Yes, but yes, absolutely. And Mr. Speaker, I'm glad you're covering that. And this is what's important. There are countless instances of reversible error in this case. Number one, the judge made poor rulings pre-trial and during the trial. Okay, so for instance, not giving the jury printed jury instructions. How is the jury supposed to apply the facts to the law if they can't see the law? They heard it verbally, but there's 34 counts. That's a lot of law. And so the jury needs to be able to see that during their deliberations. The judge deprived them of that. Let's think about this as well. During closing argument, the judge allowed the prosecuting attorney, Matthew Colangelo and Alvin Bragg, from their office, to argue facts that weren't in evidence. The first thing you learn in evidence in an evidence class in law school is that it's objectionable for the prosecutor to get up in closing argument and testify to facts that were not adduced into evidence during the trial itself. So by the judge allowing that to happen and overruling the defense objections, those are both reversible error in and of themselves. Number three at this point. The prosecutors themselves were illicitly motivated. They should have been disqualified from prosecuting this case. Think about our own experience in St. Louis. Remember when Kim Gardner was disqualified from prosecuting the McCloskey's case, or disqualified from prosecuting the police officers who she had charged with offenses because the court found that she was politically motivated? She had a personal interest in the case. The same is true here. Alvin Bragg was involved in civil litigation against President Trump. Matthew Colangelo is deployed from Biden's crooked Department of Justice to assist President Biden in his reelection to eliminate a political opponent. They should have been disqualified. That's reversible error. But then let's go to, like you're saying, the lack of unanimity in the jury instructions. This is an co-ed offense, meaning that the state of New York, the prosecution had to prove that there was a target offense that President Trump then participated in through other activity. So it's inchoate. There's a level of attenuation between the target offense, the predicate offense, and the offense for which he's charged at the state level. The problem was the prosecution never identified specifically what the predicate offense was, submitted four different options, and the judge said you don't have to be unanimous, jury, in determining which predicate offense to go with. Since 2020, the United States Supreme Court, in the case of Ramos v. Louisiana, has said that jury unanimity is required under the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution. So there's this whole case is replete with errors, and when you add all of that up, again, it points to the fact that the goal here was never a legally valid conviction. It was always politically motivated and always intended to take President Trump off the campaign trail.
We are speaking with Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey on the 34-count conviction of Donald Trump today in the so-called hush money case. Attorney General, I want to ask you, how common is it, and this happened in the trial, how common is it for a judge to tell a witness that I don't like the way that you're looking at me, and if you continue to look at me in a way that I don't like, I'm going to completely strike all of your testimony? Is that something that is common in a court?
That is ridiculous. I mean, for the judge to opine, I mean, that undermines the credibility of a witness. It invades the province of the jury. The jurors are supposed to determine whether or not they believe a witness based on how the witness is behaving. For the judge to offer that kind of commentary, editorialize on the credibility of the witness, invades the province of the jury and undermines our criminal justice system, where there's this separation of powers where judges determine law, juries determine fact. That alone, again, I think that's reversible error. I mean, the first thing they teach judges in Missouri is say as little as possible, make your rulings, and say as little as possible. Because when you start talking as a judge, you start injecting your opinion into the case, and your opinion has nothing to do with it. It doesn't matter what the judge thinks the strike zone should be. It matters that he calls balls and strikes within an objectively verifiable strike zone.
Speaking to Attorney General Andrew Bailey, Mr. Attorney General, you made reference to this earlier. Despite all the celebratory fanfare that we know is occurring right now on CNN and, as we call them, MSDNC, this is a dark day for the American jurisprudential system, right, Mr. Attorney General? Because if you put aside this is Donald Trump, and those who say, well, this is just about Donald Trump, both of those are bad, right? This shouldn't just be about Donald Trump. And you can't remove Donald Trump from this equation because now they've set this as a precedent. And that's one of the things that we respect in this country is precedent. So now that a court has said this is okay to target, weaponize, and go after political opponents, that is something that's never been done at this level in this country before. Hopefully will never be done again. But now the left has said it's okay to do so. Dangerous place to be, isn't it?
It's absolutely true. And again, that's why my office has demanded records from the Department of Justice to establish this collusive relationship between Biden's crooked Department of Justice and Fani Willis and Alvin Bragg and Matthew Colangelo, because at the point that you have President Biden on the stump deploying resources in an illicit witch hunt prosecution at the state level against a political opponent, number one, it's putting those attorneys' professional licensure at risk, which there should absolutely be sanctioned. Number two, it undermines the credibility of whatever illegal conviction they obtain today. I think that's reversible error by having these self-interested prosecutors who are politically motivated involved in these cases. But then number three, it provides an avenue for civil liability for President Trump. His civil rights were violated. At the point that the prosecutors exceeded the scope of their statutory authority, they're waiving sovereign immunity, and President Trump can sue them. And at some point, I believe there will be evidence of criminal behavior on behalf of the prosecutors, and it'll be time to prosecute the prosecutors. And the left should not be surprised when that happens, when those of us on the right lash out and strike back against this kind of behavior. If lawfare is the name of the game, then don't be surprised when it happens to you. Mm-hmm.
We have been speaking with Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey. Mr. Attorney General, we thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come on the Tim Jones and Chris Harp Show. I'm sure you will be doing many, many interviews in the coming hours, but we thank you so much for joining us, and we always enjoy talking with you.
Hey, appreciate you guys having me on. All the best to you and your listeners in this dark hour of our republic.
I agree. Thank you so much.
Indeed.
It is a dark day, Tim. 34 counts. President Trump found guilty. We are in a banana republic, and I feel like some Harry Belafonte music should be playing about now. But anyway, 507, Speaker Stump Speech. I think I have a pretty good idea what it's going to be about, but what is it?
Chris, I was going to talk about the Great Barrington Declaration, if you remember that, published by Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who I got to see speak in D.C. last week. I'll hold that to another
day. There you go.
I have found a great... Chris, I was looking for an analysis of the jury instructions, and there's going to be many analyses of these in the future, but I found one from a very esteemed source, The Federalist. I'm going to talk about Judge Merchant's jury instructions and how they're all about power, not the law, and that's why we should all be concerned.
That's coming up on the Speaker's Stump Speech at 5:07. 5:24, we'll speak with Chris DeGaulle. He's a member of the Herzog Foundation and host of the podcast Making the Leap. You are listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.